I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about a topic that I think does not get enough attention, given its importance, the significance it has, not only over the course of American history, but for contemporary American public life. And that topic is American grand strategy, how America should dispose itself toward the world, how it should act in the world. And I'm joined for that conversation today by a very eminent guest, Dr. John Hillen. John is currently a professor at Hampton-Sydney College, but he also has taught classes for a number of years in the Graduate Business School at George Mason University. Before that, he served as Assistant Secretary of State for Political and Military Affairs. In addition, he's held leadership positions as the CEO or president of several private and public companies, especially in the defense sector, and served in the United States Army for 12 years?
That's right.
12 years as a cavalry officer and as a civil affairs officer for U.S. Special Operations. And if I'm right, your father, also in the Army, was a lieutenant colonel who was a Green Beret.
That's right.
And received a Distinguished Air Cross.
The Distinguished Flying Cross. Unusual for an infantryman.
But yes.
He received it for an air mobile mission in Vietnam in late 1969, yeah.
Impressive military background, impressive military family. Thank you, of course, to you and your father and your family for your service. He holds his bachelor's from Duke University, his MA in War Studies from King's College in London, and his DPhil from Oxford University. Along the way, picked up an MBA from Cornell.
Right.
This is a man, a deeply learned man, a deeply interesting man, a deeply thoughtful man who's authored several important books, and the most recent one just out just a month ago or so, called The Strategy Dialogues, a primer on business strategy and strategic management, very interestingly, in the form of what I might even call Socratic dialogues.
That's right.
A really interesting approach. Let me highly recommend it to our listeners. If you're interested in strategic thought, business management, leadership, again, The Strategy Dialogues by John Hillen. He is also on the ACTA, Commission for the Renewal of Higher Education, a very important mission in restoring American higher education to what it should be. And I'm honored to say Dr. Hillen serves on Ashbrook's National Advisory Board on Civic Education. John Hillen, thanks for joining us on The American Idea.
Great to be here.
Your question is an interesting one that you've been thinking about and are publishing on with respect to grand strategy. And the question, as I understand it, is, can a self-governing republic have a coherent grand strategy? Now, before you answer that question, let me read you what Alexander Hamilton says. This is the Federalist number 9. He says, it is impossible to read the history of the petty republics of Greece and Italy without feeling sensations of horror and disgust at the distractions with which they were continually agitated and at the rapid succession of revolutions by which they were kept perpetually vibrating between the extremes of tyranny and anarchy. If they exhibit occasional calms, these serve only as short-lived contrasts to the furious storms that are to succeed. That doesn't sound like a recipe for success in grand strategy.
It's not. If you define success as continuity and coherence and no disruptions. I'm a huge Alexander Hamilton fan. I'm the faculty sponsor at Hampton-Sydney for the Alexander Hamilton Society chapter. And so I'm loath to say perhaps he didn't see the whole picture. But another formidable figure, another incredibly shrewd observer of the American character and the American experience, Alexis de Tocqueville, said something similar. He said that a democracy will really struggle to have a consistent, he said, foreign policy, because it's going to be buffeted around by all the hurly-burly of a popular democracy. He said it's inevitable to be erroneous and confused. And so Hamilton may have been referring to outside as well as inside forces. And de Tocqueville basically said, we're going to be our own worst enemy for being able to do this. And I think what both of them mistook in some ways is the process of putting together a policy and a strategy from the outcomes. If you're into process, you want control. So you can put all the pieces in place. And strategy itself, which is a series of moves that are coordinated in order to exploit your advantages and exploit somebody else's weaknesses, lends itself to maybe I should have an orderly process for that. And if you think about all the forces of interference in a pluralistic, diverse, unruly democracy, the kind that de Tocqueville was observing about, you know, probably 40, 45, 50 years after Hamilton wrote that, you're like, yeah, that's going to be messy. But it turns out that that messiness in a pluralistic democracy can be actually the secret sauce in its grand strategy, which really harnesses all the tools of the nation.
Okay, that's a fascinating thought to me. And your distinction between foreign policy and grand strategy.
Right.
Okay, our listeners are very historically informed, but they may not be quite so informed on these terms of art, we might say, in foreign policy and security studies. What do you mean by grand strategy as compared to foreign policy?
Sure. So foreign policy is simply the process by which the government decides what to do about the official, in our case, American role in the world.
Okay.
That policy is the sole province of, in our case, of our system, the federal government, and in particular here of the State Department or the White House or something like that. Strategy, traditionally defined, is it comes from the Greek world, strategos, for general. How a general uses the things at his disposal to achieve victory. Grand strategy pulls the lens way back and expands the concept of strategy and policy by time. It says grand strategy should treat periods of peace and war, so it should expand over time. It expands it in scale. It says, you know what, we shouldn't just consider military resources or federal government policy resources. We should consider the resources of the nation. So that brings into play commercial resources, culture, systems, patterns of social and political life that are outside of the realm of the federal government. And it also increases it in space. It just allows you to deal with a broader realm. So instead of theaters of war or theaters of conflict, and the U.S. government divides the world up this way, you know, we have European command and Indo-Pacific command. Grand strategy considers how they're all interconnected. So like anything strategic, it's long range, it's big picture, and it seeks to connect ecosystems and how they all touch each other. If you look at America through that lens, you see, you know, Ronald Reagan and Bill Buckley remind us is a nation with a government, not vice versa.
So let's talk a little bit more about the elements of grand strategy then. From the beginning, am I right to say that, for example, American grand strategy, the goal is the flourishing of the United States in the world, something like that? Or how would we define sort of the goal, the aim, the end of grand strategy from?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's written, you know, helpfully written in the preamble to the Constitution, you know, that the purposes of the Constitution are really the purposes of the country. And a grand strategy, because it captures the non-governmental pieces of the American enterprise, in particular, thinks about the common good, providing for the common good in a very broad sense. So America has always been more commercial in nature than governmental. It's always been more private than public. And that's animated this country from the very beginning and underpinned our sources of strength in grand strategy. So it's especially important to pull back the lens on answering this question. Can a self-governing people get their act together and have a coherent approach to the world and a successful grand strategy if you consider the whole nation and all the tools within it? So that's economic, informational, cultural, social, and not just armies and navies and state departments.
I see.
Because it turns out the best expression of our grand strategy on the world stage is the expression of the entire country and its encounter with the world, not just the federal government and the foreign policy parts of it.
All right, take us back to the time of the American founders then. How did they conceive of a grand strategy for this new country, America?
Yeah. Well, you know, in the pre-colonial days, there was this tension between why are we here, the European settlers. Some came for economic reasons, and that really planted the commercial gene in the American DNA, and some came for social reasons. We're going to perfect a social order. So you had utopian or pragmatic reasons, pragmatic or idealistic reasons. And you wonder as a historian, which one of these will win out? Are we an idealistic or a pragmatic country? Well, the American answer has always been both. And we see no contradiction between the two. That's been a kind of uniquely American answer to this age-old question. So their plan at very early scenes of a prominent feature of our strategic personality, which continues to stay, an unusual combination of idealism and pragmatism. The second big imprint on our grand strategy came about in the Treaty of Paris in 1783, what one historian has called the time bomb that was put inside the treaty. The time bomb was the, at first, unexpected, but then we wrapped our heads around it, a gift in some ways in the treaty of the land between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi River. Unexpected in the early negotiations that eventually got folded into the negotiated Treaty of Paris. That turned 2.9 million people clinging to the Atlantic seaboard and relying for almost all their commerce and activity looking east, that turned them to a westward-looking people. Dramatically put an imprint on the shape of grand strategy that would affect the country for the next 100 years. And in fact, our first grand strategy captured in George Washington's farewell address really had three pillars. One was form a coherent economic and political order. Washington was very concerned about that with political parties and a weak economy, all the rest. The second one was stay out of European brawling and power politics. And the third piece was expand westward. And those became the three pillars of an American grand strategy. We sometimes call them Washington's rule, that stayed with and shaped American grand strategy well up until the 1890s.
In the 1890s, of course, there's a movement toward American engagement in the world, a kind of embrace, at least by some Americans explicitly, of imperialism. Let's take territory around the world. Let's become an imperial power like the British, like the French, like others. How did American grand strategy shift, if it did, during the period of the late 19th and early 20th centuries?
Yeah, and it did start shifting then. I would say one of the best books on this is my friend Walter McDougall's book, Promised Land, Crusader State. And he sees a very clear divide between the promised land stage of American history and the crusader state. And you did see in the McKinley administration, Teddy Roosevelt administration, and their grand strategies, a pivot from Washington's original, and in some ways a continuation of George Washington's grand strategy. You see elements of the white man's burden, the so-called white man's burden. You see, as you know, flat out tinged with racism within it, like much of the imperialistic times. But on balance, as the U.S. expanded, very unusually historically, it fleshed out the continental nation mostly through treaty agreements and purchases, not through conquest. Very unusual. There was some conquest, and if you're a Native American, you've got a case to make about the whole thing felt like conquest. But in dealing with other great powers, the continental nation was formed mostly. And it was the same thing on the world stage, the purchase of Alaska. We fell into what I'll call the European game, the game we had avoided and asked Europeans not to play in our hemisphere with the Spanish-American War. But even then, I make the case that if you're judging how good an imperialist you are, America's not going to be a top-ranked imperial power. Imperial powers occupy places for long periods of time. Spain occupied Cuba for over 400 years, the Philippines for over 330. We stayed 4 years in Cuba, and we stayed about 45 years in the Philippines. Imperial powers exploit the resources of their territories. On balance, we've ended up putting far more resources into American territories than take. Yeah, there's no rare earth mineral mine or tungsten lode in Guam that has ever given back to the U.S. And so that's been part of our imperial experience. And the other thing is, if you're in the imperial game, you play the game and you compete in it. We did not take part in the so-called Race for Africa, which turned Africa from about, 10% European countries to almost 90% occupied by European countries in the space of 25 years after the Congress of Berlin. And we not only did not participate in China, but we framed the Open Door Treaty in two different sessions, which told everybody else in the world not to carve up China, but to create it as an open door where everybody could trade on equal terms. So the U.S. is not a good imperial powder, no matter what some critics may say. I would say if you're judging imperialism by what it's about, the U.S. doesn't rank very highly.
We were reluctant or even bad imperialists.
Yes, yeah. I don't think it's really in our DNA. Is American exceptionalism a powerful motivator, a part of our strategic personality? Absolutely. And it expresses itself in different ways and different eras. But in terms of using it to exploit, if that was our intent, we're not good at it. There was a famous session about 20 years ago at a conference in London where the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the Archbishops of Canterbury have tended to be have some pretty strong political opinions in the past 50, 60 years, confronted Colin Powell when he was the Secretary of State and said, is this venture of America in Iraq another attempt at American imperialism? And Colin Powell said, many times, especially in the past century, we've sent young Americans into great peril to help others far outside our shores. And the only thing we've ever asked for in return is enough land there to bury our dead. And you could have heard a pin drop. So if we're in the imperialism business, I think the best thing you can say for us imperialists is we've been bad at it.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
All right. Then, of course, you have World War I and then especially World War II. And post-World War II, a number of people have argued, as you know, that America's position in the world radically changed, that it became permanently engaged in the world and the entangling alliances of Europe, to paraphrase Washington. And that may have changed American grand strategy. Is that true?
In some ways, yes. I mean, there is some element of this was then, or that was then, and this is now. And the U.S. is now, the U.S. has been the world's biggest economy since about the 1880s, early 1890s, perhaps even a little bit sooner, according to some projections. So we've been a great power for a long time, but a great economic power. On the eve of World War II, I think we had maybe the 17th biggest army in the world. So part of that, part of the continuity of strategic personality is we've never liked large standing armies. But we always have needed a navy. Why? Because commercial maritime powers that are largely represent governments that are private and commercial in nature, not public and governmental in nature, need navies to guarantee freedom of the seas and freedom of trade. Non-intervention and neutrality for Americans meant dollar signs. And so that's always been a strong drive of American policy. Our role shifted after coming to the rescue of Europe three times in the 20th century, World Wars I, II, and also the Cold War. But we still led with our fundamental strengths of our grant strategy, which stem back to the nature of the American strategic personality. So, for instance, Roosevelt's grand strategy in World War II had three basic pillars. One was Europe first. So Europe was going to be the more important conflict. We're going to win there. And that really helps with priority setting and sequencing, and came up in almost every great debate between the Allied chiefs of staff and the war. The Europe first policy has a tremendous strategic effect. The second one is we're going to mobilize American industry to win this war. At the end of the day, the U.S. took about 2% of the military casualties in the war and ended up the war with about 85% of the world's advanced manufacturing capacity. It took 0% of the civilian casualties. The U.S. provided 10% of the troops in the Allied coalition, provided 2/3 of all the equipment used by the Allied coalition in the war. So God bless the men who landed on the beach, on Omaha Beach, but that was not the secret to American success in the war. The war, I think you could say fairly, was largely won through Soviet sacrifice, British resistance and pluck, and American industry, and bringing this weight to bear. Same thing, the Cold War, did we field large militaries? I was part of the Reagan buildup in the 1980s. Yes, we did. But the Marshall Plan, the using our economic might, the stitching together of the Bretton Woods Agreement, and the underpinning of a system that ultimately led Europe to be whole, free, and peaceful and prosperous, encouraging our fallen adversaries in Germany and Japan to be prosperous members of productive members of an anti-Soviet coalition. This is a very strange way to go about the world. Why would you put into place a grand strategy by which others gain relative power compared to you, the sponsor of the strategy, including your fallen adversaries and potentially including future rivals?
Right.
It's a very unusual grand strategy historically. But what it created was, you know, what we know is the American-led world order. And it all stemmed not from our great Navy, which was great, our great Army, which was also great, our great Air Force, our nuclear. It stemmed from these traditional sources of American strategic strength, which is, you know, the nature of the nation, not the tools of its government.
And we saw some of that in the 1980s. I'm thinking, for example, of the economic competition between the United States and the Soviet Union. And the notion, for example, as Ronald Reagan always used to say, look, just let the market be free in the United States, let American enterprise flourish, and economically we will so outgrow the Soviet Union that we will be able to afford significant defenses and innovative technology, for example, the Strategic Defense Initiative, right? That's part of our strategy to defeat the Soviet Union is to just unleash the American economy.
That's right. And there's a famous memo, a Presidential Decision Directive 75, I think it was, in 1983, which laid out exactly that. The economic pillar of Reagan's national security strategy, not economics for its own sake, but in the furtherance of his national security goals, was probably really the thing that won the Cold War and toppled it over. And it was a recognition of this traditional and to this very day investment in the sources of American strength. One of the obvious sources is our geography, our so-called splendid isolation and a resource-rich land. But the other sources of strength are our culture and the nature of the American nation as it developed, this private commercial nation. And so to this day, our focus on industrial strength, technological innovation, being a financial powerhouse, these may seem like they have nothing to do with foreign policy and certainly nothing to do with military policy, but they've actually been the secret sauce of American grand strategy success. And here's where I'll just come back to Hamilton and de Tocqueville. I can understand why people want control of the foreign policy process, but you can't argue with the outcomes. The U.S. went in 200 years from being an infant nation that might have died in its crib to 200 years later being not only a country, but a system, an ideology that vanquished all other rivals so that none were left on the scene, including all the systems and powers that had long preceded it. That's quite an accomplishment in 200 years. And for about half of that, the country really wasn't paying attention to anything but its own affairs. So I think the outcomes that any pluralistic, diverse, interesting, inventive, creative democracy can produce on the world stage are better than the ones that autocratic, authoritarian countries who control their policies so closely can.
Some people are saying, as you know, that the Trump administration is pursuing a strategic reorientation of the United States, at least of American foreign policy, on some very specific issues. Do you see a reorientation of American grand strategy? Is it too soon to know that? Or do you see a continuation of traditional elements of American grand strategy?
It's probably going to be a bit of both, but an adjustment is absolutely not only coming, it's happening. And some might even say, so what is it an adjustment from? American grand strategy, in fits and starts, but largely since the end of World War II, has been oriented on investing in a system or system of systems that our power underpins. Financially, it's a system oriented towards open markets and open commerce and open trade.
So, for example, the World Trade Organization.
Exactly. Or any element of the Bretton Woods series of economic agreements. Okay. It includes things like the IMF and the World Bank and the U.S. as a reserve currency and all the rest of it. And this would be something that would be absolutely sensible to a William Morris from the founding era. You know, I mean, but the ink wasn't even dry on the Treaty of Paris. And William Morris had financed a clipper ship called the Empress of China and sent it over to Guangzhou. And without any permission from the United States government, such as it was in 1783, the Articles of Confederation government, he opened up a trading mission and a U.S. legation with no authority there. So this has always been the American mindset, right? So that's really on steroids after World War II. And the whole world has benefited from those, choosing to play in that system, and the U.S. the most. But now in the air now is an adjustment from that. Was that an overinvestment? Have we been taken advantage of by that system? That system, for instance, prompted the rise of Chinese economic power, now our greatest challenger.
Right.
Geostrategically, economically, a friend of mine, Matt Podger, wrote a great piece in Foreign Affairs called Beijing's American Hustle, showing how they had used the open system to benefit, and they channeled their benefits into investment in order to challenge American national security interests. And we need to be aware of this. The other part of the post-World War II arrangement is American hard power and soft power would underpin security arrangements through treaty organizations like NATO, in other words. Retrenchment is in the air. An adjustment is coming. This post-World War II liberal, and by liberal, I mean in the old-fashioned sense of the term, open international order, underpinned by American power and supported by allies, is fraying. It's fraying both by circumstance, and it's fraying both by purposeful decisions. And I think ultimately, an adjustment period has been happening. I think the Obama administration tried to adjust it in its own way, largely based upon the thinking still prevalent today, and including with the new Trump administration, that we overinvested in Iraq and Afghanistan post 9/11 and don't have much to show for it. So retrenchment has been in the air. There's an adjustment of this. These basic tenets of American grand strategy have been in place for about 80 years. That's happening right before our very eyes, and how it plays out and how fast it plays out, we'll just have to see.
Some people are arguing today, as you know, that we are seeing the rise, Tocqueville's revenge, I'll call it, authoritarian regimes, yeah, particularly Russia and particularly China, who seem to be on the rise, projecting power, claiming spheres of influence, and being certainly aggressively, in the case of China, exerting its soft power around the world with a different approach to grand strategy that seems to be pushing the United States, and some people say moving the United States out of the way toward a world where China is the leading global power. What do you make of the argument that Chinese authoritarian style can be a successful grand strategy?
Walter Russell Mead uses a very interesting analogy. He calls it the difference between a lighthouse state and a mirror state. A lighthouse state is the traditional way we think about forming strategy and policy. There's the lighthouse, super smart set of people at the top of the lighthouse, and they shine the light. This is where we're going. It's very clear. It's very determined. And we're going to control it from here. America is what Walter Russell Mead calls a mirror state. Our policy reflects who we are as a country. And that's the way we make policy. Now, as I've spent out throughout our history, this reflection has turned out to be a huge set of advantages. This reflection of this hustling, inventive, commercially oriented, non-public, restless peoples that make up the American nation. That reflection in policy instruments and grand strategy has been very successful, as I pointed out. But these are the two systems that are running up against each other now. The basic shape of the world and its geopolitical tectonic plates is team authoritarian surveillance states against team market democracies. And that's not an exaggeration. If you look at the way I did a map overlay once in one of my classes about where people voted on a Ukraine-Russia resolutions, the UN, and where countries voted on Israel-Gaza resolutions. And people separated neatly into these two camps, just on those two issues. And the amount of cooperation, as Hal Brands and other great geopolitical brains have pointed out, between the authoritarian surveillance states is extraordinary. The amount of economic, technological, military intelligence cooperation between, in this particular instance, China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea is really unprecedented. So they think of themselves as a team, and they have a team goal, and they say it. This is not me making it up. They actually say it in their strategic documents, which is to expel the U.S. and its influence and ideas from what they consider to be their rightful spheres of influence. So, for instance, this system I mentioned, the U.S. invested in a system and systems of systems after World War II. Among those systems is a system of how we think about political and social order, human rights. The UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights is not that universal because it's unthinkable for an authoritarian surveillance regime to input. Any of the freedoms in the U.S. Bill of Rights could not last for 1 minute in Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, or other authoritarian states. So they're pushing back regionally in what they consider to be their legitimate historical spheres of influence, and also on the global stage, because ultimately, for China to succeed as a great power, or any other authoritarian power to succeed in its region, they can't live in a world which the basic rules about human order, about political organization, about human rights, about economic activity, economic life, social life, political life, is set by somebody else on terms that are inimical to the way they think they should run their government. So this is the essential geopolitical tension we're in and we'll be in for a while. A system characterized by the things I described since World War II, or spheres of influence mentality about whoever's strongest in that area makes the rules, and whatever rules they make, they want, they get.
When you start thinking about particular countries and their policies, they do seem to sort of fit into those categories. I think a lot of, thinking about your book, The Strategy Dialogues, and your connection of the business world to the analysis of geopolitical phenomenon that you're giving us, our listeners, particularly young people, who are interested in sort of, okay, how do I start to think strategically? What should I be studying? What should I be reading? This sounds fascinating. How do I get into this and start thinking and doing this?
Right.
What's your advice?
The meta lesson in the book is that strategy is not a what to think. Make this product here, invade this country there, you know, make peace there. It's not an outcome. It's a way to think. So the strategic mindset is a way to think. I mentioned some of the characteristics of it. It's long range, not short term. It's big picture, not narrow window of perspective. Analysts break problems down. Strategists seek to pull things back together. They see how ecosystems connect to each other and then affect each other. I would also say, you know, strategic thinking is realistically optimistic. There's a kind of art of the possible creativity to it. So if you tell me my institution has a problem, if I'm thinking strategically, I recast that problem as a set of options to go to a different place in the future. So I'm no longer thinking of it as today's problem. I think it was tomorrow's opportunities.
Right.
And then I'll weigh and And I'll go through a bunch of frameworks to weigh the pros and cons of those opportunities.
It's a mentality. It's a way to think. I use the analogy, there's certain muscles in your body that a good trainer can help you activate so you know how to use them. It's the same thing with strategic thinking. There's a part of your brain. It's quite literally a different part of your brain. It's more right brain than left brain, than thinking analytically that you use when you think strategically. And if you know how to activate it, you can use it. So you don't need to hire a fancy consulting firm. You can think through it yourself. You just need the know-how and some frameworks. I think the baseline for this, especially for students interested in the kind of things we're talking about today, is history. You have to have a baseline knowledge of history in the same way a company would want baseline data about markets and trend lines and all the other things. So that's the laboratory that every strategist has to work within.
The American Idea podcast, our listeners love history. So that's good news for them. And I always like to ask this question of distinguished guests like yourself who have studied these things so deeply. And maybe it's an unfair question, but your favorite American strategic thinker.
We've had some good ones, and we've been blessed. I would put Alexander Hamilton in the top ranks. One of the great strategic questions weighing on the country in its early republic years is, what kind of country shall we be?
Yeah.
And he and Thomas Jefferson famously argued about this. In fact, I think Lin-Manuel Miranda in the musical Hamilton captured it brilliantly in the two cabinet debate scenes. Were they debating a policy issue? Sure. In one case, the bank, in one case, neutrality of the war. They were debating a philosophy,
yeah,
of what kind of country would it be. So he turned out to be a fantastic strategic thinker. And think of the themes I've talked about that animate the American strategic personality. They're Hamiltonian themes, with some exceptions, right?
Yeah.
Commercial, inventive, industrial, financial, oriented on continental progression and economic development and so on and so on. And then as you move along, I think Alfred Thayer Mahan reread, and then probably the great American geopolitical strategist of the early 20th century, a fellow named Nicholas Spykman. Everybody's going to want to start understanding geopolitics, and more maps should show up in every classroom.
Amen to that.
Because it's really, really important, and he made a great contribution. And in fact, I think you can understand a lot of what the world is about today and its emerging geopolitical shape from studying these old grand strategists. And I'll give you this one too. Coming to the present day, to keep your eye on, I mentioned his name, I think Hal Brands is probably the most talented young geopolitical thinker we have in the country today. And obviously Walter Russell Mead as well. Anything either of those two write, anybody interested in geopolitics should get their hands on a thing deeply about.
Very good. Well, you heard it, folks. Start with Alexander Hamilton. That's great advice and a great conversation. Let me again recommend the book to our listeners, The Strategy Dialogues, A Primer on Business Strategy and Strategic Management, by Dr. John Helen. John, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.